IB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
This one lay.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the case of Ahmed Arbery, the black American man who was jogging and killed by white men in southern Georgia last year, was not an anomaly in the United States. White men killing a black man while saying they thought the black man had broken the law has been happening as long as this country has existed. And now, the trial of the three men involved in his killing is taking place in front of a practically all-white jury. Will stay with us as we take a look at this story on the Spotlight. I'd like to start it off crossing over to D.C. and talking to correspondent Wyatt Reed. Wyatt, thanks so much. Good to see you. Wyatt, tell us what's going on. So the trial is starting, and fill us in, please.
That's right. We have seen at least one day so far of argumentation, and as you correctly pointed out, due to what's called preemptory laws that affect how juries are drawn, we are seeing a jury that is almost entirely white. 11 out of 12 jurors who will decide the guilt of Ahmaud Arbery's killers are white. And this is partly to do with the fact that the judge allowed the prosecutors significantly fewer, about half as many attempts to dismiss jurors from the pool. So that is indeed, at least from an optic perspective, and really from a race perspective, more broadly, pretty disturbing in and of itself. What we know about the case is Ahmaud Arbery was jogging a new Brunswick, Georgia neighborhood on February 23rd, 2020, when three men, Travis and the McMichaels, Gregory and Travis McMichael, father and son, as well as their friend who's filming this encounter, essentially chased Ahmaud Arbery with their vehicles, allegedly hit him with the vehicle, and then killed him with firearms, supposedly acting in self-defense. Ahmaud Arbery was not armed. The men who were responsible were not arrested. And in fact, it was only until 2 months later, it was only 2 months later when video of the event surfaced, that anything done at all. So as you can see, this is another case in which really justice for the victim of another racial killing seems to be the kind of thing that's very hard fought and not forthcoming unless it's something the family members are willing to fight for.
All right. Thanks so much for that update out of Washington, D.C. Wyatt Reed. Well, I'd like to welcome our guests to this Spotlight. Social activist and senior pastor, Reverend Graylin Hagler, out of Washington, D.C. And writer and journalist Abayomi Azakiwi, out of Detroit.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines. featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us, Reverend Hagler. Good to see you again. Reverend Hagler, I mean, it is hard for some people who really have never lived in the United States or really cannot understand to fathom that in 2020, a black man could be jogging, not doing anything in a white neighborhood and killed simply because he was black in an all-white neighborhood. I mean, try to break it down for our international audience who perhaps really cannot relate to what this means.
Well, that's part of the history of the United States. There were sundown towns. When I say sundown towns, there were towns where if you were black or a person of color, you couldn't be in after sundown. And that continued to exist basically all the way through the Civil Rights Movement, and even to a great extent right now, because I remember even when I was in Chicago, and I used to drive over to a suburb just next outside of Chicago. I used to get pulled over by cops all the time for no reason and questioned. So that's a continued pattern in the United States where whites want to live in segregated neighborhoods that are insulated and isolated from anybody else. When they see anybody else, usually they've put it in the category of that they're there to steal, there to kill, there to maim. And so they really think that they have to defend themselves even against a defenseless, unarmed jogger.
Well, let me cross over to Detroit, talk to Abayomi. Again, thanks so much for being with us. When we look at the situation, what Reverend Hagler just said, that simply just being in that neighborhood, a black person, many times it's just assumed that he's done something. He's committed a crime. And we saw in this case, too, these three white men basically said that they thought that he had committed a crime. I mean, talk about this mindset and how we got here, because I really do feel that for people who have not lived in the United States and some of these other countries, it may be a little bit difficult if they haven't seen this themselves, this breakdown in racism so sharp and so evil, let us say.
Well, thank you for the invitation once again. And yeah, I think it goes back to the 2.5 centuries of enslavement of African people in the United States, where we were considered property and we were to be contained and controlled, exploited and oppressed. And even after the Civil War and the legal abolition of slavery, that is still the mindset of law enforcement, as well as a lot of whites. Who feel that African Americans have no right to be in certain areas, and even in their own communities, they are subject to stop and frisk and other forms of harassment. I mean, these three white men had no right whatsoever to ask Ahmed Arbery to stop. I mean, this is not the period of enslavement. They just say, oh, hey, black man, halt, halt. No, they have no right to say that. And he had no weapons. He had no property on him. He was jogging. Just because you stop to look at a construction site doesn't mean that your intentions is to commit a robbery. So this is totally an outrageous fabricated defense that they're coming up with. And I think the jury selection process, which the judge commented on during the opening arguments in order to cover himself, but he could have, and he said he couldn't, he could have declared, a mistrial. They could have started over with the impanelment of a jury that was more representative. I mean, it's going to be very difficult. We hope that these majority white panel will reach a just decision, but it's going to be extremely difficult for the prosecution to argue that these three white men were not justified and killing this African
American. Well, stop right there, Leone. Uh-huh. You just said something, because, of course, we know that it's only one black man on the jury, 11 others white. And you said it would be hard to get justice, or hard, basically, I guess, to this case to be judged fairly. Does it mean that people will not look at the evidence in the case and just basically judge this based on color only?
It happens all the time. Just on Press TV earlier this week, it was a report about a study that was done by the New York Times that indicated that 400 people have been killed in routine traffic stops over the last 5 years in the United States. So they're operating with a bias that any black person, woman or man, youth or adult or senior citizen is suspect. So anything they do to you is justified, and they can rationalize that they felt threatened by your presence, by your refusal to cooperate with their command. So this is a major problem right now in the United States, and no matter how much the government says that we cannot defund the police, we cannot dismantle law enforcement in this country, it has to happen in order for justice to be served in these type of cases and in thousands upon thousands of other cases that are ongoing right now in the United States.
Reverend Hagler, this murder took place in Georgia, and is it that the South is more racist than the North, or is this something that could have happened anywhere in the United States? I mean, does it make a difference?
Well, it's something that could happen anywhere. I mean, Minnesota's in the North, Georgia's in the South. George Floyd was killed in Minnesota, and Aubrey was killed in Georgia. It doesn't matter whether it is North or South, but because there's a mentality that exists. And the other guest is just raising the issue exactly correctly. As he talks about, really, there's a pervasive structure in America that racism is built into it. Now, for the average white person in the United States of America, they have a very hard time seeing racism. They call it, and they've gotten conditioned to call it everything else, from being conservative to being basically to the right, all of those other types of things. But it's actually racist when the groups like the Conservative Political Action Committee meets. That's made up of all of the white supremacist groups in America, including the Republican Party. But folks do not see it as racism or as racist. They see it as basically conservatism. That's what exists. So to be able to talk about, in the Aubrey case, that somehow race was a motivating factor that caused these three white men to break out there and kill Aubrey, it's hard for white America to see. It's hard for white America to understand. Just like you're talking about, it's hard for the world to understand the fabric of America. It's hard for white Americans to understand what racism looks like, the impact it has, the effect it has, and the fact that it is also put in place and maintained through laws and rules so that whites remain in power as the dominant culture and basically can lock up and kill black folks or brown folks.
Abiyomi, we saw mass protests in the U.S. last year against racism and police violence. Nothing has changed, but we have not seen those same types of rallies this year. Now, many say that racism was used to pressure the Trump regime, not to really make a difference in the racist actions in the U.S. Your thoughts on that?
Well, yes. The election of the current administration of Joe Biden was in large part in response to the mass demonstrations that took place in the aftermath of the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and of course George Floyd, and many others who were killed during 2020. And some people felt with the election of Joe Biden that things would change. Unfortunately, they have not changed. And a clear indication of it is that the failure of the U.S. Congress to pass the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act earlier this year indicates that they have no intentions of reining in the police or defunding the police or restructuring the whole concept of public safety in the United States. So people are going to have to go back out into the streets. They're going to have to assess where we are right now as a country in order to move forward effectively, because the police are the first line of defense for the ruling class in this country, which is racist, and they feel they have to strengthen law enforcement in order to maintain the status quo.
Reverend Hagler, are black people any safer today than they were, let's say, 20 years ago, 100 years ago? How would you compare?
They're probably a little safer than 100 years ago, but 20 years ago, I'm not so sure. Because what I continue to see and what we continue to see are things like illegal police actions, extrajudicial killings. We see the courts being filled and overloaded with black people. The jails are overflowing and loaded with black people. So we see the same type of oppression that continues to go on and on and on.
So why do you say they perhaps were safer 100 years ago?
No, I didn't say we were safer 100 years ago. I said we're safer today than 100 years ago because 100 years ago, in fact, in Red Summer, 1918, towns and hamlets were burnt down, disappeared, people were killed in mass. Tulsa, Oklahoma, 1921, whole town was burnt down, people were killed in mass. 1898, in Wilmington, North Carolina, there was a coup d'etat launched against the elected town council, and the town council was assassinated, and whites put themselves in power, back in power. So that's what I'm saying, that there was a difference in terms of you could do that with impunity, and you had no repercussions, you had no video cameras in order to record it, you had virtually no reaction from anybody,
right,
including the Justice Department, the U.S. government, or even from the citizens who basically had to cower in fear. It is a little bit different today. Thank God we can get to the street. Thank God we can demonstrate. Thank God we can declare Black Lives Matter. Thank God we can do all of that, still under great risk, great fear of going to jail for a lot of folks, but we can still get out there and do it and come together and be united as a people and as a community.
Abayomi, the problem with racism is critical in the U.S. to the extent that there are growing talks of secession. Racism has been a problem since the beginning of these United States of America. Do you think the division of this country could resolve or at least lessen the problem?
I think it could lessen the problem. The difficulty is that there's so much invested in the oppression of African Americans and other people of color that it's actually to the benefit of the ruling class to continue the status quo. If we talk about 100 years ago, what happened in Tulsa, in 1919, there was also a riot, so-called riot, actually it was a massacre of 300 African-Americans in Arkansas, whose only crime was they attempted to form a sharecropper's union to get adequate compensation for the growing and selling of their crops. This was their crime. And they were attacked by a white mob, including law enforcement, and 200 to 300 people were killed. Ida B. Wells Barnett wrote a book called The Arkansas Riot of 1919. It's chilling to read that book. But today, people are still being gunned down in the streets. And moreover, if you look at the criminal justice system, the majority of people who are in prison in this country are black and brown people, and an even larger majority are black, brown, working class, and poor people. There are virtually no billionaires in the prisons, no billionaires on death row in this country. So even though they may not have the lynch mobs that they had in 1919 and in 1921 and in other years, the police, the courts, the prosecutors, and the corporate media essentially plays the same role as the lynch mobs. They put people in conditions in which they can be arrested, and then after they're arrested, they're railroaded through the courts, they're put into the criminal justice system, even after they get out of prison. It's very difficult for people to even find housing, to find employment. So the problem is still here.
Mm-hmm. Reverend Hagler, what would you say? There are many who say that actually black Americans, African Americans, were better off during segregation than after integration. During segregation, there were many vibrant black businesses, black doctors, all type of activities in the black communities. And the dollar actually stayed in the black community much longer than it does today. I mean, what would you say to that?
Well, to some degree, that's absolutely correct in terms of economics, and that the community actually did business with itself, was forced into doing business with itself. But also at the same time, the black community was denied political power, was denied representation in elected offices, the right to vote, all of those other things, as well as tax processes that were put in place to penalize black people for owning land, even for being engaged in business. So even though segregation sort of benefited to some degree a black community, it also disempowered that black community as well, politically as well as economically. So you got to look at it in terms of both sides of that coin, the benefit of that one side and also the negative abilities of the other side of the coin.
And Abu Yomi, where do you see the United States headed? I mean, the country seems more divided than ever. Is there light at the end of the tunnel or on the horizon? Or do you see a continual deterioration in race relations in that country?
It appears to be a continuous deterioration. We look what happened on January 6th. It was interesting Reverend Hagler mentioned the Wilmington coup in 1898. These people in Washington attempted a national coup. Although it failed, they're using different tactics by drafting new laws to prevent African Americans and other people of color from voting in states around the country. They're doing all types of activity on a legal basis to accomplish the same task that they could not carry out on January the 6th. So I think the country potentially could be in for another civil war. But I think the task of the activists and the progressives is to take that civil war and try to turn it into a revolutionary war. To actually change the society from the bottom up. I think that is the real only solution that we have.
Okay, and on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me on the Spotlight. Senior pastor and social activist, Graylin Hagler, out of Washington, D.C., and writer and journalist, Abu Yomi Azikiwe, out of Detroit. And as always, appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. So when the horn is blown, no relationship will there be among them that day, nor will they ask about one another.
Brothers and sisters, we were talking about the 101st verse of chapter Mu'minun. فَإِذَا نُفِخَ فِي الصُّورِ فَلَا أَنْسَابَ بَيْنَهُمْ يَوْمَئِذٍ وَلَا يَتَسَاءَلُونَ. And when the trumpet is blown, there will be no relationship between them that day, nor will they ask of one another. So the previous verses were about the barzakh, or the life in intermediate world. And now this verse is describing the day of resurrection and what the wrongdoers will feel in that resurrection and in that world. So it says, فَإِذَا نُفِخَ فِي الصُّورِ فَلَا أَنْسَابَ بَيْنَهُمْ. There will be no relationship between them. They will not use the bonds and ties of this world. The kinship of this world is no longer effective in that world, and family relationships will be of no advantage to anyone. And as we said in the previous program, by having a look at other verses, even the mother would ignore her suckling child. And this is how people will feel that day. And at the end of the verse it says, وَلَا يَتَسَاءَلُونَ, nor will they ask of one another. One possible interpretation for this sentence is that they will not ask each other for help because they know that this request is not of any use. Some commentators have also said that the verse means that they will not ask each other about their lineage. And this is supported by the preceding phrase where it says, فَلَا أَنْسَبَ بَيْنَهُمْ. There will be no relationship between them. The first commentary seems more probable. Of course, there is no contradiction and conflict between the two, because it is possible that this sentence could refer to all of the meanings.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Now, one question remains, and it is that in other verses of the Holy Quran, we read that people have different questions to ask of each other. For example, one verse of the Holy Quran says, "And some of them draw near unto others, mutually questioning." Or, "The inhabitants of paradise will ask the inhabitants of hell, 'What has brought you to this burning?'" مَا سَلَكَكُمْ فِي سَقَرْ. But why does this holy verse say, "Nor will they ask of one another"? وَلَا يَتَسَأَلُونَ. Is there a contradiction or conflict between these verses? The answer would be clear by having a closer look at the meanings of these verses. The point is that these two matters do not contradict each other. The first instance of questioning mentioned in this verse, I mean the 101st verse of chapter Mu'minun, verse in question, "Nor will they ask of one another," concerns the onset of the day of resurrection. And it is about the onset of that day and the phase before people are sent to paradise or hell. But the verses, the other verses we talked about, the other instances of questioning mentioned in the verses of the Holy Quran, for example, the inhabitants of paradise asking the people of hell, "What has brought you to this burning?" مَا سَلَكَكُمْ فِي سَقَرْ. And they try to answer each other's questions. These types of sentences and these types of verses are concerning the situation after the reckoning. And it concerns the people of paradise questioning the people of hell. So now it has become clear that these two groups of verses do not contradict each other, because one of them is talking about the onset of the day of resurrection and the other group talking about a situation or phase after reckoning. That's it, dear listeners. We are done with the 101st verse of the chapter. In the next couple of verses, the Holy Quran talks about how the different deeds of the people in this world will affect their situation in their resurrection day. Thank you for staying with us. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Last-minute, high-level talks in Paris to avert French sanctions on the United Kingdom did not produce any breakthrough, but both sides have agreed to continue discussions. A dispute over fishing boat licensing surprisingly ballooned into swift threats of sanctions and bans on using French ports unless London backed down. The row only concerns about 200 French fishing boats, some of which may be unable or unwilling to prove that they have not been fishing illegally in UK waters. The extremely low economic impact of the dispute has many saying the affair has become overly politicized, with French President Emmanuel Macron posturing ahead of re-election next spring, and the UK with their own questionable motives.
We see the economic problems the UK is having after Brexit, with shortages of gas and goods that appear rather serious. This dispute allows their government to focus attention elsewhere. But fishermen of both nations always have an interest in finding harmony together and sharing natural resources.
But the dispute does reveal the complex and long-lasting nature of the Brexit secession. Analysts say that as the UK's largest trading partner, the European Union holds the best cards. Tougher customs checks, which have not been implemented since Brexit, could cause major delays for British companies and costs which far outweigh sales of fish.
France's Prime Minister recently shocked many when he asked the head of the European Commission to, quote, show that it is more damaging to leave the Union than to stay in it. The openly punitive stance has many saying it's an unabashed method to keep countries in the European Union, not by persuasion, but by intimidation.
The EU still doesn't exclude the use of sanctions, but they have consistently been in favor of more negotiations. Our government has said they will follow the lead of the Brussels. So many French fishermen have a real feeling of injustice and of being neglected. We certainly hope our government will put pressure on London, because we cannot go on like this with major losses.
Many expect Brexit to become a perpetual problem in UK-EU relations. And with France, sometimes an ally, sometimes a competitor, but always a neighbor, bilateral relations are likely to get more strained as Brexit solidifies into permanence. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
Former prosecutor, anti-corruption maverick, and political novice Yoon Suk-yeol Friday won the nomination to run for president of South Korea for the Conservative People Power Party.
The South Korean people, who want to restore fairness and common sense in our society, have chosen me, a political novice. Instead of happiness, I feel a sense of responsibility and duty to achieve a change of government.
Former provincial governor Lee Jae-myung won the Democratic Party nomination October 10th and proposes a universal basic income among several liberal policies.
Rooting out unfairness, inequality, and corruption, and making a wealthy country where workers are respected are the clear and stern commands from the public.
Early polling shows the candidates running neck and neck.
I support Yoon Suk-yeol because I think that the government of this country ridiculing people should be replaced as soon as possible because lies after lies continue.
I support Lee Jae-myung because he has gone through very difficult times and overcome everything by himself to get where he is now. And he is open and above board as well as firm.
The two main candidates for president of South Korea, conservative Yoon Suk-yeol and Democrat Lee Jae-myung, clash on a number of issues, including North Korea policy. Lee favors peace-building engagement with Pyongyang, whereas Yoon advocates strengthening the alliance with the United States through regular military exercises. South Korea's presidential election is slated for March 9th next year, with the winner set to serve a single 5-year term. Frank Smith, Seoul.
France has been shocked by a report which found that 20% of all the nation's hospital beds have been closed since the start of the pandemic. That total number of closed beds is twice as many as in 2019. Which also reveals that hospitals have been running at under capacity for some time. Unions gathered to clarify the situation, and they said it's even worse than it seems. The 20% number includes private hospitals, but it's public hospitals which have seen their funding cut almost annually since 2009.
As recently as the year 2000, France's medical system was ranked number one in the world by the United Nations. That claim can no longer be made following more than a decade of austerity, and perhaps no group has protested as often in recent years as medical professionals.
It's not only the lack of resources which is keeping hospitals underutilized or even closed, but also a lack of medical personnel. Studies show that during the age of austerity, public jobs, once eliminated, are not returning, even in hospitals during a once-in-a-century pandemic. What unions repeatedly accused is that the coronavirus is being instrumentalized by France's neoliberals to accelerate their open and long-standing goal of defunding public services even amid the corona instability.
We have this conviction that the government is manipulating corona because they were forcing the cuts before corona. Only the cuts are now coming even faster. In the middle of a pandemic, hospitals are being closed and services are no longer being offered, from our biggest and best public hospitals to smaller ones.
For public medical professionals, working conditions and pressures have dramatically worsened over the last 20 months, causing many to quit and turn over to the private sector. Unions say many of those resigned posts also never get refilled. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Soon after, Prime Minister Modi won a landslide victory in the 2014 general elections. Like other leaders, he wouldn't shy away from talking about the spirit of democracy. The Prime Minister said democracy will sustain only by freedom of speech and expression. But in Modi's New India, it looks like a different story altogether. Journalists in the world's largest democracy are caught in a limbo, not just about how to report, but also what to report. Many fear for personal safety, right to report the facts, while others are intimidated, harassed, and even charged under draconian and sedition laws. Some are threatened aggressively. A poignant case is that of Indian journalist Neha Dixit, who revealed a horrifying ordeal while receiving a prestigious International Press Freedom Award.
The last couple of years have been about endless follow-up and legal cases, death threats and rape threats, complete with descriptions of how it should be conducted on my body. They've also been about being held physically hostage by right-wing Hindu fundamentalists while reporting.
Nevertheless, the show goes on. While tuning in to watch your favorite primetime, where abuses, yelling, personal attacks, and at times cracking laughter is a routine. According to New York-based hybrid research and journalism organization, The Police Project, 256 reports of violence against journalists in India were recorded from May 2019 till August 2021. Media experts say press freedom has further diminished after the emergence of Hindu nationalist government of the ruling BJP. Recent years have seen a dramatic rise in violence against journalists while they were covering stories on different issues. Social media is also becoming a tool
for trolling and threatening not just journalists, but anyone. Many renowned journalists and media personalities have now shifted their platforms in the pursuit of truth and perhaps the other way of the narrative. Rather than appearing on big platforms, they have resorted to social media as an easy tool to put forth their side of the stories.
There is a culture which is not limited to one political party or a particular government, but there is a culture now that has been developed where people who kind of bring out inconvenient truths are questions.
Experts say after the emergence of BJP in India, there is a sense of polarized environment where journalists find themselves more divided, while many are still confused if it's all about patronizing the popular rather than speaking about the unpopular. But the never-ending or perhaps unwanted debates find more space in Indian media platforms rather than the ones that makes difference. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Europe's vaccine rollout got off to a rocky start at the end of 2020, and now, almost a year later, even distribution across the bloc has not been achieved. In Romania, only 30% of the population is vaccinated. Now it's in the grips of its most deadly wave, with all intensive care beds full and patients being turned away. In Germany, 65% of the population are double jabbed, but some regions are going into lockdown again, and those refusing the jab are being barred from indoor spaces. And in Britain, 67% of the population is double jabbed, and 8 million people have received booster jabs. Nonetheless, with social distancing laws scrapped, numbers are skyrocketing. While some countries are still struggling to give everyone a first and second dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, others are rolling out booster jabs. And the blame game is in full swing. Governments are slamming vaccine hesitancy and lack social distancing, while citizens across Europe are saying they just don't trust the people in charge. The very same leaders who promised poorer nations their fair share of vaccines, but have not delivered. The World Health Organization has slammed the likes of Britain and Israel for rolling out booster shots, while the majority of poor countries haven't even vaccinated their most vulnerable.
The clue is in the name, it's a pandemic. And until everybody is vaccinated and everybody is safe, then nobody, theoretically, is safe. And we are seeing what's been called vaccine nationalism, vaccine apartheid. And this is part of Western hegemony, Western hegemonic values, a sense of Western exceptionalism, that poor countries, they can wither on the vine as long as we've got enough vaccines. And it's a case in point that Western countries are far more their vaccines in store than what they really need. But there's a reluctance to give out these vaccines, one, because there's a selfishness that is part and parcel of Western society and Western ideology, but also, I think, a sense that Big Pharma wants to start making a profit from these vaccines and is not minded to give them out for free or at cost, as they were to Western countries and Western governments. It's all about power, it's all about imperialism, and it's sowing dragon's teeth in a time of pandemic.
Vaccine apartheid is to no one's benefit. It undermines a global recovery and allows more virulent virus variants to appear. Scientists warn waning immunity from vaccinations could mean many more people across Europe getting sick and dying this winter. Bianca Rahimi, London.
To fish or not to fish, at the center of an escalating row between France and Britain, after France seized one British trawler and fined another for not playing by the new rules.
The UK used to be part of the EU common fisheries policy that allowed all European vessels equal access to these waters. But after Brexit, everything changed. Now both the EU and UK vessels have to have licenses to be able to fish in each other's territorial waters. And not only that, they have to prove that they have done so in the past.
To make things more complicated, the self-governing British territories of Jersey and Guernsey in the Channel Islands issue their own licenses. France accuses the UK of granting a small number of licenses it's entitled to. Britain denies that.
The French have behaved unfairly. You know, it's not within the terms of the trade deal. And if somebody behaves unfairly in a trade deal, you are entitled to take action against them and seek some compensatory measures.
But why is this happening now? In France, it might have something to do with an upcoming election.
There is an election coming up, and therefore President Macron would like to wrap himself in the flag, and particularly if it's an opportunity of actually having a go at the British. But also there's an issue that actually, in terms of a broader EU sense, that actually want to make sure that Britain isn't seen to be benefiting by leaving the Union.
And on this side of the channel, it's all about reminding British voters of the perks of Brexit.
The British Prime Minister, Johnson, is trying to make sure that he is seen to be strong, standing up against the French, and that Brexit is being a success. The fishing industry as a part of the economy is tiny in Britain, but it's a very emotional issue. And of course there, he said he would be standing up and protecting the fishing industry, and frankly, he hasn't been doing so.
The French have threatened to prevent British vessels from docking at their ports if the issue isn't resolved soon, against Britain's threats of legal action. For now, though, the two sides seem to have hit the pause button on tit-for-tat measures. Key talks are set for later this week, with experts saying the risk of further escalation remains. Saeed Pourriza, Dover, United Kingdom.
Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip marked the 104th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. They also expressed their anger towards the British government and its continued support to the Israeli regime. In 1917, then-British Foreign Secretary Arthur James Balfour issued his declaration giving Zionists the permission to usurp Palestinian land. The Balfour Declaration led to the displacement of the indigenous Palestinians upon the creation of the Israeli regime in 1948. Hamas movement vowed to continue resistance against the Israeli occupation.
The Palestinian people are still suffering from the repercussions of the ill-fated Balfour Declaration, which created a Zionist entity on holy Palestinian land. The Balfour Declaration will be trampled upon by the Palestinian people. After 104 years, we maintain that all form of resistance will be used to liberate all of the historic land of Palestine.
Palestinian refugees, who make up most of Gaza's population, demanded compensation from the British government for the pain and suffering for more than 7 decades.
We want to liberate the land of Palestine and return to the towns and villages from which we were expelled. The Zionists have no rights here and have no place in our land.
The United Kingdom, along with the United States, have been the strongest supporters of the Israeli regime. Senior Palestinian officials demanded that the British government must compensate Palestinians for the grave pain and loss.
Britain has started our misery, and the United States has taken it upon itself to continue this injustice by supporting the Zionist occupation and giving it the green light to violate the rights of the Palestinian people. Both Britain and the United States have been making attempts to turn the Israeli regime into a military superpower.
104 years on, the Balfour Declaration continues to plague all aspects of life for Palestinians. The Balfour Declaration is considered by most Palestinians as the root cause of their suffering under the Israeli occupation. They also blame England for their plight. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
People in the Gaza Strip held a demonstration in front of the Red Cross office in the Gaza Strip to express solidarity with Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails who are on hunger strike in protest to their harsh conditions. 7 Palestinian inmates are in a critical condition due to their hunger strike against the illegal administrative detention practiced against them.
Palestinian inmates have resorted to hunger strike as their last means to defend their rights. Israel's illegal administrative detention must come to an end. We are here to call human rights organizations to pressurize Israel into ending the illegal policy.
In a press conference held during the demonstration, the participants warned against the deteriorating health condition of the prisoners in Israeli jails.
We are here to show our solidarity with our brothers in Israeli jails. To this end, we have gone on a hunger strike to send this message to our brothers that they are not alone in their struggle against Israel. We won't sit back and are ready to pay the price for defending our rights.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails have witnessed heightened pressure over the past years. There are reportedly about 5,000 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prisons, with a great number of them remaining in jail without any charge.
Supporting our inmates are among our top priorities. We feel duty-bound to defend our brothers with all possible means. To this end, we have organized a number of events to highlight the plight of Palestinian inmates inside Israeli jails.
Israeli authorities keep Palestinian inmates under harsh conditions, from lacking proper hygienic standards to systematic torture. Several Palestinian detainees have been on their hunger strike inside Israeli jails for more than 100 days, protesting their arrest with no charge and the harsh prison conditions. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have begun the hunger strike in solidarity with the prisoners whose lives are at risk. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
The 2nd of November is remembered by Palestinians as a disastrous date in history. It's the 104th anniversary of the so-called Balfour Declaration that pledged on behalf of Britain in 1917 a homeland for the Jewish people in historic Palestine, as every year the Palestinian flag was flown at half-mast mourning this date. Palestinians say the declaration was the first official recognition of the Zionist project by a world power, leading to widespread legitimization of the cause and the eventual establishment of Israel.
Balfour Declaration was one of the worst conspiracies against the Palestinian people. It aimed at depriving us from our right to our homeland, depriving us from our right to have our state, our own state. And it has led to a very severe disaster, which is the ethnic cleansing of about 70% of the Palestinian people in 1948.
The Palestinians are demanding the United Kingdom to apologize for the declaration, and they blame Britain for helping Israel in its occupation of Palestinian territory. But it seems this apology won't happen, Palestinians say, as more world countries harm Palestinians, especially after former U.S. President Donald Trump invented the so-called deal of the century that envisions the Israeli annexation of large swaths of the occupied West Bank. Even after 1 year of his departure, current U.S. President Joe Biden is weak to be able to change Trump's promises to Israel.
Many colonial countries have agreed together to harm the Palestinians and their cause. But our people are still steadfast on our land and dissolve the conspiracies. Trump tried through the so-called deal of the century, first to allow Israel annex the West Bank to prevent a Palestinian state on the 1967 lines with its capital Al-Quds, and never reaching a resolution on the refugees problem. The UK helped Jewish gangs to have a state on our land. U.S. is supporting them up until the moment.
Palestinians say that the Balfour Declaration has always served as a reminder of the suffering of Palestinians during the decades of Israeli occupation, colonialism, and Judaization.
It has been over a century since the notorious Balfour Declaration. Palestinians today warn that the U.S. support of Israeli encroachment into Palestinian territory is as dangerous as Britain's Balfour Declaration and is definitely helping Israel to prolong its occupation and annex Palestinian land. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran.